humbly to get to be here today with you to honor you on behalf of everyone in this great state of Alaska.
Governor Palin sends a Fort Wainwright Stryker Brigade unit to Iraq. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 11th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, observations of polar bears this summer on scattered ice in the Chukchi Sea.
This flight seemed to confirm that indeed, even if the sea ice cover there is relatively low, polar bears will try and make use of it, and walruses will too.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Alaskans welcomed home Governor Sarah Palin last night in Fairbanks. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, thousands were on hand to celebrate the recently named Republican vice presidential candidate, while others outside the event rallied against her.
The governor pulled up aboard a jet emblazoned with the McCain-Palin logo to a hangar packed with a sign-waving partisan crowd at Fairbanks International Airport. Palin took to the podium with her family, much like she's been doing around the country since being named John McCain's running mate.
Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great honor and privilege to introduce you, our wonderful governor and the next vice president of the United States of America, Sarah Palin, and her husband Tom.
Palin's speech was an Alaskanized version of the one she wowed the Republican National Convention with 2 weeks ago.
I want to thank you, Alaska, for your support and for your encouragement. And what we've been doing is taking our campaign on the road, of course, across the nation. And we've been carrying our message of reform to the American people. And we've been talking all about Alaska, and people are impressed. And you know what they're really excited about knowing more about? And that's Alaska's oil and gas. And everywhere we go, they're chanting, drill, baby, drill. And I saw the signs over there.
Many in the crowd last night said they were there to witness history, to see the first Republican woman vice presidential candidate and first Alaskan to make it onto a presidential ticket. They say they're impressed with Palin's superwoman persona and tough politics.
She's just out of this world. We'd miss her if she gets to be the vice president. We'd miss her as our governor, but she would still do for Alaska.
She's just down to earth, and she's a mom, and she seems real.
I like everything about her. I like what she did on in the legislature, getting the gas line approved, and everything that she's done.
The Republican Party made it clear that last night's event was to support Sarah Palin and John McCain, but outside the hangar, a sign-waving crowd of protesters assembled.
To support Obama and let everybody know that not everybody feels that McCain's choice was wise.
You know, she really plays to the apple pie-ness of who she wants people to see that she is. Like right now, we're looking at what you might call per diem fraud. We're looking at Troopergate. You know, we're looking at incidences where she has been terribly less than forthright with the Alaskan people.
I think they're dishonest and they're mean-spirited. They've got all these rove operatives in there, and we're seeing the same kind of nasty swift boating as we saw before.
Other specific concerns cited by protesters included Palin's opposition to listing of the polar bear as a threatened species and her support for the war in Iraq. Sarah Palin took a break from the campaign trail Thursday to honor a previous commitment to help send off the Fort Wainwright-based Stryker Brigade. Palin was the keynote speaker at a deployment ceremony on post.
It is humbling to get to be here today with you to honor you on behalf of everyone in this great state of Alaska. And we do applaud our mighty warriors.
Governor Palin's son, Track, is part of the 4,000-member Stryker unit, which is deploying to Iraq. In her speech, Palin acknowledged the risk and loss that comes with service and recognized fallen members of the previous Fort Wainwright Stryker Brigade that served in Iraq during 2005 and 2006.
Not far from here is the 172nd Stryker Brigade Combat Team Memorial Wall. My husband Todd and I recently visited that. It was dedicated in 2006. It bears 36 names. These were 36 of our own, soldiers last seen facing down the enemy in places like Mosul and Rawah, Tel Afar, and Baghdad. They were all brave volunteers. They all stood where you stand now. And like many more before them and after them, they were all lost in the broad conflict that began 7 years ago today.
Palin tied the fight in Iraq to defending our nation from those who carried out the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, adding that Americans can never go back to the false sense of security we once had. Fort Wainwright's 1st Stryker Brigade will deploy overseas during the next 3 weeks. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A group of Anchorage women are planning a Reject Palin rally Saturday to show that Governor Sarah Palin does not necessarily represent the political values of all women. Sharla Stern says the nonpartisan rally will ask people to look at Palin's politics and positions on the issues before deciding how they will vote.
Our rally itself, we intend this to be a nonpartisan rally. We're actually not really campaigning for or against anybody. We're just trying to encourage people to actually be informed before they go to the polls and make the decision for themselves.
She says she has talked to people with very different beliefs who also disagree with Palin on various issues. Word of the rally seems to have sparked some anger. Stern says once an Anchorage talk radio program announced it and gave out the organizers' phone numbers, a lot of intemperate messages soon arrived.
I'm damn sorry you missed my phone call, too. You liberals need to get a life. What is wrong with you? You think you speak for everybody? You don't speak for nobody but your individual stupid selves. Get out of the world.
And don't go around and tell people that you are standing up for all the women of Alaska. That's not right.
I just heard on Eddie Burke about you. You people are disgusting. How can you call yourself a woman?
Stern says some of the messages were scary enough that last night she was considering not showing up for the rally herself. But in the morning, she decided to go through with it. She is still quite surprised at the anger the rally has prompted.
It's pretty disconcerting. It's pretty sad that, you know, the level of discourse can degrade so quickly.
Anchorage radio personality Eddie Burke has now published the phone numbers on his website. The rally will be Saturday at noon at the Lusac Library in Anchorage. A legislative committee charged with figuring out why fuel prices in Alaska have been slow to come down with the price of crude oil heard testimony in Fairbanks yesterday. State Assistant Attorney General Ed Sniffen told the committee this summer's lag between the falling cost of oil and the price of gas and heating fuel refined in state is unprecedented.
The historical trend has been to always lag a little bit behind. And when I didn't see prices go down right away, I thought, there may be some of this catching up that's happening that we normally see. And I waited about a month, and I still didn't see them fall.
Sniffen and the committee are looking to Alaska's three oil refiners to understand what's going on, and representatives from Tesoro, Petrostar, and Flint Hills were on hand at yesterday's hearing. Jeff Cook with Flint Hills says the price of its gasoline would have been much higher earlier this summer, but the company has absorbed some of the crude oil spike.
If you were to look at the traditional relationship between crude and retail price of gasoline, it would have been closer to $6 a gallon. I can only speak for our company, and that is, for the majority of the last 12 months, we have lost money.
Cook and other refinery representatives said their companies are still trying to recover from absorbing some of crude oil's peak earlier this summer. Statistics show that refiners in other western states responded far more directly and quickly to the up-and-down crude market. Antitrust laws prevent refiners from sharing price calculations. But Sniffen says the state has subpoenaed that information for confidential review to try to understand what's going on in Alaska. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, tracking down the source of a higher birth defect rate among Alaska Natives.
We know that trichloroethylene has been associated with major defects of the heart. Some of these same defects are showing up in Alaska Natives.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
The state held a successful lease sale that included more than 36,000 acres of land on the southern flank of Mount Spur for developing geothermal energy. KBBI's Mike Mason has the details.
Wednesday's Mount Spur geothermal lease sale was only the third such sale in the state's history, and the State Division of Oil and Gas is characterizing the sale as very successful. The sale brought in over $3.5 million, and all of the 16 tracts offered received bids. Ormat Technologies was the highest bidder for all but one of the tracts. Ormat is considered the leading geothermal developer in the United States. Paul Thompson is the company's director of policy and business development. He says Ormat believes there's a great potential at Mount Spur and is anxious to get started exploring that potential.
We're going to send our resource team and geologists out to Alaska to evaluate it, look at, you know, all of the variables, economic factors and so forth, and then decide, really try to define the resource, the area we want to develop first, and look at trying to gather as much information and evidence that we can and that we need to start drilling swim holes and things to prove the resource.
Thompson believes the actual field work at Mount Spur will begin sometime next spring. Ormat Technologies designs, develops, owns, and operates geothermal power plants across the world. They currently operate power plants in the U.S., Guatemala, Kenya, and Nicaragua. Chris Rose is the executive director of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project. He says the lease sale will lead to more geothermal exploration of the Mount Spur area.
The work that's been done thus far at Mount Spur was quite a while ago, and it was mostly surface work, geochemical, geotechnical work. And my hope is that Ormat will go in there and finish up what other surface exploration they need to do before they actually do some drilling, because we need to have some exploratory drilling over in that area to find out exactly what the resource is.
Rose noted that Ormat Technologies is a member of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project and has a history in the state of Alaska. The company supplied 100 remote gate valve power systems used on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and the first geothermal unit developed by Ormat was for the University of Alaska Fairbanks for use at the Manly Hot Spring. Rose says a Mount Spur geothermal project could be part of a larger series of renewable energy projects on the west side of Cook Inlet.
There are several projects that are being considered, including Lake Chacachamba. And if Mount Spur is developed and or Chacachamba is developed, they can share that transmission line. So Spur is one of those interlocking pieces of potentially much larger renewable energy development on the west side of Cook Inlet that could benefit the whole rail belt.
The leases that will be awarded later this month or in early October are 10 years in length with an option for another 5 years. Kathy Means is a natural resource manager in the state's lease sales and lease administration unit. She confirms that the leases include certain milestones that must be met by the leaseholders.
The first one is submitting a plan of operations for doing exploration, and we will be monitoring that progress to make sure that they are doing the exploration in accordance with their plan.
Wednesday's geothermal lease sale included state-owned lands along the southern flank of Mount Spur, and the sale area is located about 40 miles west of the village of Tyonic. Wednesday's sale was the third such sale in Alaska history. However, the sales in 1983 and 1986 never resulted in the development of a geothermal project. In Homer, I'm Mike Mason.
The U.S. Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee approved legislation today that would allow a land swap in the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge on the Aleutian Peninsula. The village of King Cove wants the land to build a road on what's now designated wilderness. They say it's needed for medical emergencies, but environmentalists say the land is irreplaceable. It's a controversy that's been brewing for a decade. From Washington, APRN's Libby Casey reports.
With one simple vote in the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, the villagers of King Cove got a step closer to getting their road.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed no. Ayes have it. The bills are approved.
Committee Chairman Democrat Jeff Bingaman led the unanimous vote to approve a slew of land bills all at once, including one that would exchange lands in Alaska. It calls for the King Cove Native Corporation and the state of Alaska to give the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service 61,000 acres in exchange for about 1,800 acres in the Eisenbeck and the Alaska Peninsula National Wildlife Refuges. Residents of King Cove say they need the land to build a 9-mile gravel road to connect their community with Cold Bay, which has an airport. The bill was sponsored by Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski.
It was a good sign today to have this compromise legislation move through the committee unanimously. It was a good day.
Officials from King Cove, like City Administrator Gary Hennig, came to Washington this week to lobby for its passage out of committee. Hennig says the road could offer life-saving airport access and generally help the village.
It's all about quality of life for the residents of King Cove to have the ability, the peace of mind, the dependability, the safety of knowing that we can get from King Cove over to Cold Bay.
King Cove did get funding a decade ago, $37.5 million for a medical facility and a state-of-the-art marine hovercraft that can take them to Cold Bay and its airport. But Hennig says the medical center isn't attracting staff and the hovercraft is not sustainable in the small, remote community.
Simply because we can't afford it, the operating costs are an issue, and the weather.
Environmentalists were disappointed that the bill passed through committee so easily Thursday. Mary Beth Oakes is the D.C.-based director of the Wildlife Refuge Program for the Wilderness Society. She says the focus should be on helping the villagers of King Cove ensure that their hovercraft can work properly. Oakes says the slender isthmus where the road would be built is the feeding grounds of rare goose and is recognized internationally as an important wetlands area.
This is an area where migratory birds go to feed. It's got the largest area of eelgrass in the two lagoons, and it also is a migrating corridor, this little tiny isthmus is a migrating corridor for a number of animals, caribou, bear, and others.
Senator Murkowski says she understands concerns, and that's why the Senate Natural Resources Committee worked out a compromise to try and make sure that the road would leave a small footprint. That's not enough for the Wilderness Society's Mary Beth Oakes. She says as long as there are plans to build a road through designated wilderness, her group will keep fighting.
We're going to be working it very hard, and as I mentioned, we have folks who care very deeply about the designation of wilderness and what that means.
Now that the bill has made it out of committee, it can go to the floor of the Senate for a vote. A similar bill is waiting to be voted on in the House. In Washington, D.C., I'm Libby Casey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the new AT&T, your world delivered.
Anchorage and Alaska officials are warning consumers not to eat raw peas grown by Mat Valley Peas in Palmer. Laboratory tests confirm 18 people in Anchorage, Matsu, and the Kenai Peninsula have contracted bacterial enteritis since August 1st. State health officials say the Palmer peas are the most likely cause of the outbreak. One of the 18 people was hospitalized. No one has died. Symptoms of the disease caused by Campylobacter bacteria include vomiting, abdominal pain, fever, and bloody diarrhea. The Mat Valley peas were distributed to retailers in 5 and 10-pound bags labeled with instructions to cook peas before eating, but some retailers in Alaska have been selling them in smaller quantities without the cooking instructions. Most people infected with the bacteria recover without medical treatment. The links between cancer and environmental toxins will be the subject of a lecture given tonight in Anchorage. Dr. Devra Davis is a University of Pittsburgh Cancer Center epidemiologist and toxicologist who is working with researchers at UAA to look at why Alaska Natives have a higher rate of birth defects than the general public. The State Epidemiology Division released a report recently looking at those high birth defect rates in Alaska Native infants. Davis says many of the pollutants that reside in the fat of marine mammals are being ingested by subsistence users. But she says a solvent called trichloroethylene that is widely used on military bases is linked to birth defects in animals.
And if you look at animal evidence, we know that trichloroethylene has been associated with major defects of the heart. Some of these same defects are showing up in Alaska Natives.
Davis says the information from animal studies show the hazards of these solvents. She says the question is what proof is needed to protect humans from this danger.
And I think it's a matter of public policy that what we want to do is take information where we have it from animal studies and use it to prevent human harm. And get away from this notion that we have to prove that people are already sick because they've been exposed to pollution.
Davis says there is good news coming from cancer research that shows there are beneficial things in our diet that can help reduce the damaging effects of toxic pollution.
And among these things that seem to be protective are things in fish oil, the omega-3 fatty acids, as well as calcium and vitamin D. So we know enough already to know that people's diets can be useful in protecting them from some of the damaging effects of pollution. And so we're doing research now on how to enhance the defense of the body from the damaging effects of toxic pollutants.
She says the U.S. government also must promote the Stockholm Convention, an international treaty that seeks to ban numerous toxins. And Davis says enough is known now to urge military officials to prioritize the cleanup of the 700 old military sites in Alaska. She says transformers filled with PCBs are some of the most obvious components of the legacy of military pollution that have been cleaned up.
But there's still a long way to go. And I have spoken personally to a number of people at military bases who are deeply concerned about this. And yet I think at the top levels, this has not become a matter of priority. And it's understandable, but I think that has to change. And the United States has to join with the rest of the European and developed world in understanding that it's very important that we leave the environment cleaner for our children and our grandchildren.
Devra Davis will be speaking tonight at UAA's Wendy Williamson Auditorium at 7 p.m. and tomorrow at Providence Cancer Center at noon. Both talks are open to the public. Links to more information is at our website, aprn.org. Before Governor Sarah Palin started dominating the national media, polar bears were probably Alaska's most famous residents. The animals have been in the news recently after the Interior Department decided to list them as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. This summer, the bears have faced the second greatest ice decline on record in the Arctic Ocean. But as the main ice sheet retreated north, it left a thin tongue of broken ice over the food-rich areas of the continental shelf. USGS polar bear researcher Steve Amstrup got to see the bears make use of this remaining ice on a recent flight over the Chukchi Sea. He says he spotted thousands of walrus and five polar bears.
One of the things that was really interesting is that we saw a kill. So even in that low concentration sea ice, the sea ice being mostly 20 to 30% of the ocean being covered by small bergy bits of ice, polar bears that were out there were able to continue to catch seals, at least at some level. One of the things that's important about this is that this little band of ice or tongue of ice that's coming down from the main pack is still over the continental shelf. And our studies have indicated that the sea ice over the continental shelf is the preferred habitat for polar bears. That's the most productive waters in the Arctic, and those are the places where we think polar bears have the greatest access to catching seals. And this flight seemed to confirm that, indeed, even if the sea ice cover there is relatively low, polar bears will try and make use of it, and walruses will, too.
In the past months, since the Interior Department decided to list polar bears as a threatened species, the animals have frequently been in the news. Have you seen inaccuracies or misrepresentations? And if so, what have you heard or read?
Well, perhaps one of the biggest misunderstandings that I've seen portrayed in the public media is the degree to which you can count on global climate models to make projections into the future. And this is a really important point because the projections that we made for polar bears in our series of reports last September were based largely on the outputs from these general circulation or global climate models. And what people say is, well, climate models aren't reliable for predicting or projecting beyond a certain time frame. Often you hear people say, well, they're not much good beyond 10 or 15 years. And actually, if you think about how these general circulation models work, it's probably the opposite case, that they're more, the longer into the future you look, the more reliable they are. And so if we look 10 or 15 years into the future, there's a lot of uncertainty as to how much sea ice might be left. But by the time you get 50 or 100 years out into the future, it's pretty clear that there will be very little summer sea ice left if we continue to increase greenhouse gases on the trajectory that we have been.
Is there any evidence that perhaps polar bears are starting to adapt to sea ice loss?
We haven't seen any evidence of polar bears changing their ways in any of the fundamentals with regard to how they make a living. Polar bears are entirely dependent on the sea ice because that's where they have evolved to catch their prey, which is largely ringed and bearded seals. Polar bears have become the largest of the bears because of the very rich food source that they have in these marine mammals. You can think of these seals as giant fat pills that are laying out there for polar bears to catch. And those giant fat pills have allowed polar bears to become the largest of all the bears. For them to adapt to something else, we're talking about adaptation as an evolutionary process. It takes many generations to occur. And it's possible polar bears could adapt to something given enough time, but certainly the changes in the sea ice that we've seen so far haven't allowed enough time for adaptation because polar bears live up to 30 years.
I can't imagine how interesting your work has been all the years that you've spent engaged in studying polar bears and in these remote places. When you look at the overall picture, it sounds quite gloomy for the future of polar bears unless some fairly significant things happen quite quickly. What is your level of concern for the future viability of polar bears' populations?
I view the future of polar bears from sort of a cautiously optimistic standpoint. I have great faith in the ability of humans to understand what they're doing and to turn it around in order to not only make sure that polar bears survive, but to head off a lot of the influences in other parts of our environment that global warming is having and is projected to have. In the near term, it's likely because of the inertia in the climate system, because of the heat that's already built up but not yet expressed in the Earth's system, we're going to get warmer no matter what we do. And the degree of that warmth may cause polar bears to disappear from Alaska, for example. And after having studied polar bears for 28 years, it's hard for me to think that there wouldn't be polar bears in Alaska.
Steve Amstrup is a polar bear researcher for the United States Geological Survey. To hear more from Steve, including his take on whether polar bears could ever adapt to land, go to our website, aprn.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of our stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Mike Mason in Homer, and John Ryan in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Proffitt is our webmaster. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Alaska has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has been sexually abused or injured by priests or anyone working for the Fairbanks Diocese. The deadline is December 2, 2008. Claim forms are available online at dioceseoffairbanks.org or by calling 1-888-570-6269. This message is sponsored by the Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.